So today we're happy to have Eva speaking, and she will be talking about closed spring tachyons, ADS CFT, and large end CD.
So I'm going to discuss some work that my student Alan and I have been doing, which we just put out in a paper last week. So starting a little bit generally, as you know, supersymmetry breaking is important. And I want to emphasize that it's not just important for low energy phenomenology, which is of course very important, but also in the sense of our needing to understand generic physics in any background. If you have 32 supersymmetries above 16th order in the momentum expansion, you've run into quantities which are not protected by supersymmetry. And in order to understand the theory, we need to understand what that dynamics is. And the advantage of breaking supersymmetry in that regard is to push those things down to early orders in the momentum expansion. In particular, at leading order, we hit the issues involved in the potential energy, which include the possibility of tadpoles, of tachyons, and even if you solve those two problems, of the vacuum energy. Now we've learned that, as with many other physics questions, non-perturbative dualities can help us understand these questions involved in systems with broken supersymmetry. And perhaps one of the more detailed examples of a non-supersymmetric duality that has emerged is the one between non-supersymmetric orbifolds of ADS5 times S5 and the low energy limit of the quiver theories that emerge on D-brains at orbifold points in 10-dimensional type 2B spacetime. Some of the elements of the duality dictionary that arise in this case, there are strongest in the strict large N limit, which on the gravity side means working classically or at genus zero. If you consider the closed string orbifold prescription on this background, you immediately realize that at this genus zero order, processes described by correlation functions involving only untwisted fields should be inherited from the parent ADS5 times S5 theory. And this was beautifully demonstrated directly on the field theory side in an analysis of planar diagrams given by Bershadsky, Kakushadze, and Vafa. Furthermore, it's tempting to assume that the Ramon sigma models that appear as the gravity side description of these models will have the features of ordinary closed string orbifolds, which would also entail preserving the symmetries that are present in the parent sigma model, including the SO4,2 isometry group over here that corresponds to the conformal symmetry in the field theory. And so one obtains a tentative prediction for large N conformal invariants of these models. And then you can continue to think about corrections and consider quantum mechanical processes involving higher genus diagrams on the gravity side and non-planar diagrams on the field theory side. And one of the things we became interested in right away was the map between the cosmological term, which is a dilaton potential on the gravity side, and beta functions that are generated at from non-planar diagrams on the field theory side. Today, what I want to discuss is some concrete things we've learned more recently about the role of tachyons in this duality. In a subclass of these orbifold theories, one finds tachyons emerging in a twisted sector of the closed string orbifold. And they emerge in the classical spectrum of the closed string theory, so they affect physics at genus zero. So which subclass am I talking about? Well, there's a distinction between models in which the orbifold group acts freely on the S5 component of the geometry and models in which it fixes some or all of the points on the S5 component. And it's the cases where there are some fixed points on the S5 which produce tachyons in the twisted sector of the gravity theory. When the overflow group acts freely on the S5, twisted states have to wind some finite distance around the sphere, and this induces a winding energy which kicks their masses, their mass squares well above zero, and there are no tachyons in this subclass of models.
Well,
yes?
If squared is small, cannot you have also tachyons in the case the freely acting group?
If what is small?
If G square n is small and you have a string in size of sphere, cannot also the gamma which act?
Okay, so heuristically, you might expect that as you shrink the radius, these guys could become tachyonic. But really, you don't know the answer to that question because all those scales are becoming commensurate with each other. And what I'm going to do is work on the field theory side, which is the reliable place to calculate in the small radius limit. And we'll find that, in fact, in these cases, there's a simple reason why the lack of an instability persists to small radius or to weak Tift coupling on the field theory side, whereas in these cases, we will find a corresponding instability. But I really would caution against trying to take too seriously this kind of heuristic based on the gravity side in a system involving strong remote fields in a sigma model that we really don't have control over yet.
Is it right to assume that the duality persists for unstable systems?
I think it's important to investigate the theory well enough to see whether it does or doesn't. And to me, it's almost tautological that orbital folding should commute with duality if the orbital fold prescription makes sense non-perturbatively on one side of the duality, because these duality statements are statements of equivalent descriptions of one and the same system. So if in one description you have a complete orbital fold prescription that makes sense, it automatically maps to something on the other side, and the question is, what is that orbital fold prescription?
So I'm scared of whether this is a test or this. Because, for example, you can make the same formal argument about the so-called non-supersymmetric duality between type 0 theory and the M theory on circle with one boundary condition. That is another example.
There's an assumption that goes into it, which is that the overflowing prescription makes sense non-perturbatively.
Right.
You can ask the same question here, and what I'm going to offer today is further concrete evidence that the duality does make sense, that the instabilities on one side do map over to the other side. I agree this is always a question, but I think it's too quick to dismiss all such cases from the start.
You probably come to this, but when you said there are tachyons in the bulk, there are some, I mean, this is some tachyons in ADS are okay if they are above.
These are, right? Okay, these, the mass squares of these tachyons scale like the string mass scale,
okay.
So they're well below the Brighton-Miller-Friedman bound. Yes, I should have emphasized that. Okay, but so I'm going to keep in mind this distinction between the free actions and the non-free actions. And I'm going to spend most of the talk today describing or computing effects on the field theory side of this non-free action case, which yields instabilities which appear to correspond to the tachyons, which are there.
So is that supposed to tell us how to do free dynamics in these Ramon-Ramon backgrounds?
If the duality is correct, yes.
You can't use field theory to study the guys in blue at the end of the last transparency.
Well, what I'm going to do is...
You can't use supergravity.
Exactly, exactly.
Right.
So as in any ADS-CFT system, the only way we know to calculate a small Tift coupling is using the field theory, and indeed that should tell us the answers for the gravity side, which we can't work out independently with current technology. Okay, so let me continue, and I'm pretty soon going to summarize the results, so if there are further questions, they'll hopefully be answered. Okay, so this distinction between free actions on the sphere and non-free actions on the sphere has a simple manifestation if we back away from the near horizon limit and consider the full D-brain system on the orbifold fixed point. So consider a general orbifold of R6 by some group gamma, and consider D3 brains placed at the orbital fixed points of this group. if you have a non-free action on the S5, that comes from an orbifold plane in R6, which has codimension less than 6. So the most extreme version of this is what's known as type 0, where you simply mod out by minus 1 to the F, don't do any geometrical action, and fix the entire sphere. You can act on one complex plane, fixing an S3 in the S5, or act on two complex planes, fixing an S1 in the S5. In all these cases, there are some dimensions, which I'm calling parallel dimensions, which are parallel to the orbifold fixed plane, but transverse to the D-branes, so that when the D-branes hit the orbifold point, they can separate along these parallel directions into fractional branes. And this is a distinct branch of the world volume moduli space that appears in these cases when the action is not free on the S5. When the action is free on the S5, that comes from a case where the orbifold is codimension 6, so that the D-branes are at the same codimension as the orbifold fixed plane. And when you move them to the fixed plane, they have no dimensions in which to separate into fractional branes. So this new parallel branch that we identified in the non-free case is not present in these cases whose near-horizon limit is a freely acting orbifold on the S5. And what we're going to find is that there's an instability along this branch, this parallel branch of the moduli space, which corresponds precisely to the cases in which the orbifold acted not freely on the sphere and where there were tachyons in the large radius limit. Okay. So before I go on, I'm going to start by summarizing the question that we're addressing and the results that we've obtained. So, as I've said, we find a tachyon in the classical spectrum in these non-freely acting orbifolds, and the question is, what does that mean on the field theory side? There is only one Brian Green. Okay. So, what I'm going to spend most of today doing is explaining the calculations that we've done more recently, which generalize a type 0 effect noticed by Seitlin and Zaremba to all of these non-freely acting orbifolds, in which one finds a Kalman-Weinberg instability along this parallel direction of the, this parallel branch of the moduli space. And this analysis is good for small Tift coupling, which should correspond to small radius of the gravity side, so it doesn't directly answer this question at large radius, but it provides a field theory answer to the corresponding question at small radius. Furthermore, we can analyze the symmetry breaking patterns that emerge from this Kalman-Weinberg potential, and you find local minima, which include infrared sectors, which simply contain the gluons of a pure glue SUN QCD sector. Finally, we analyze the independence of these results and find that the order in the one over n expansion that these effects, that these contributions affect the theory, agree with those of the genus zero gravity side tachyon, and the symmetries also map over to what you'd expect from the genus zero gravity side tachyon. And that's something of a surprise, which I will go through carefully. So now, as Jacques was saying, what we can reliably calculate is on the field theory side, and we don't have an independent description of the gravity side yet. But these results motivate obvious conjectures for what the gravity side should look like. First of all, the fact that we find an instability on the field theory suggests that the tachyon instability has persisted even at genus zero. It's a small ADS radius. And this we can say at least globally, and I'll explain what I mean by that when we get to the calculations. finally, in gravity side, non-supersymmetric tachyon decay condensation processes and non-perturbative gravitational instantons, people have come to the heuristic conclusion that sometimes things decay to nothing by these processes, and I'll review that heuristic picture and observe that in this case, from the field theory analysis, we can identify exactly what you decay to, and indeed you decay to something with fewer degrees of freedom, but not all the way to nothing, at least to the in the regime of validity of our calculation.
Is there any conceivable way that something which had a gauge rule would decay to nothing?
Well, you could Higgs the whole thing.
Trivial fixed point, that would be the same thing.
Just a confining theory.
It's just by motion in time versus motion in radius. I mean, is that what you're going to address? Gauge take place in time, whereas the flows take place in radius.
I'm going to be thinking of them as taking place in time.
In time.
In time. But what I'll do is just look at the what's going on near the local minima of this potential. And indeed, what I'm trying to say here is we're kind of revising this idea that things should decay to nothing to saying that things should decay to the dual of these smaller, in some sense, these more generic field theories. But there is...
Because for, yeah.
So, what's the comment?
What would be the gauge rule of the roots of fine?
Right, that's the kind of issue here. I mean, you do see that you lose some of this heuristic picture is right in the sense that you do sort of lose degrees of freedom in the infrared. You do mouse up the matter and so on. So. It seems like the lesson here is that you decay to something less than you had, but not to nothing. At least, you know, around certain minima that we have so far analyzed.
Couldn't the decay to nothing be a patient with one filter with no stable vacuum?
There could be.
Because the decay to nothing, it's always decaying, it never stops.
It never stops. Yeah, no, that could be. Mm-hmm. And as we'll see, there are limitations to the regime of validity of these calculations, and that could happen here. Well, the other thing is in ADS-CFT, U1s tend to decouple in ways that are still mysterious. So if you Higgs all the way down to just U1 factors, that might be like decaying to nothing.
What's dual to nothing in theory with the mass gaps? What's trivial in the infrared? I mean, I'm trying to understand the dictionary that's being conjectured here. I mean, is that?
It's not relevant to what you're talking
about. Okay. I don't want to leave you with the impression that everything is sorted out here. In fact, there are some very, at least to me, intriguing puzzles that arise in our analysis. As I say, I'll mostly focus on the field theory side because that's where I feel we have control. But there are a couple of puzzles that I hope to get to at the end. One of them involves the fact that a non-planar diagram leads to a non-zero beta function corresponding to a double trace quartic scalar coupling, which, although it's a non-planar diagram, it turns out to affect correlation functions of twisted operators at large n. And this seems to contradict this heuristic argument we had based on the SO42 symmetry that shouldn't happen. And I'm going to discuss...
Also the variable tachyon points
start the so on the gravity side, you have a tachyon potential, a tachyon mass term that occurs at genus 0.
Whether the size of the variable tachyon is accepting the large n count.
I don't think so, but I'll explain accounting carefully when we get there. And the second thing is that this kind of perturbation by a double trace operator is something whose gravity side description is not really yet known in the ADS-CFT correspondence. And if some of you talked to Ofer and Miko when they were here, they had some very interesting ideas about that also pertain to these models because we're also talking about double trace perturbations. So I'm going to explain that, if that wasn't clear to you at the end, hopefully. Okay, and finally finishing the summary of results. In the case of free actions, I more or less already said this, at large radius we found no tachyon in the spectrum, and at small radius, namely at weak coupling on the field theory side, this branch along which an instability, a Kolmogorov-Weinberg instability developed in the other cases simply is absent here in these models. So you get a nice satisfying picture where there's no such instability at weak coupling on the field theory side, leading to, I think, a pretty plausible conjecture that there's no instability for any radius at large n for these models where the orbifold action was free. Okay. So now to start getting into the details, I want to first consider the simplest, in some sense, case of type 0B, where you orbifold by minus 1 to the F, which fixes the entire S5, and the quantum field theory dual is a simple quiver or moose theory in which you start with two D brains and act on their Chan-Patton indices as well as on the fermion quantum number with the Z2 action, which leads to a spectrum involving gauge fields in the adjoint of SUN times SUN and six real scalars in the adjoint of SUN times SUN. And fermions appear in bifundamental representations and n bar plus n bar n of that SUN squared gauge symmetry. The tree level interactions are inherited, and now the tree level in the gauge theory are inherited from the n equals 4 theory Lagrangian. The bosonic interactions are exactly those of an SUN times SUN n equals 4 superangles theory, including the usual commutator terms. And Yukawa couplings couple the bifundamental fermions to the adjoint scalars in this way. The classical moduli space, because of the commutator terms, are commuting matrices, which satisfy this SUN condition that the sum of the eigenvalues is 0. This model has an important Z2 symmetry, which exchanges the first and second SUNs, which corresponds to the well-known quantum symmetry of the closed-string orbifold model, which acts on twisted states of the orbifold model and leads to selection rules for their correlation functions. And there are quote-unquote twisted operators like trace F1 squared minus trace F2 squared, where these are the field strengths of the two SUNs, which transform under this symmetry, and these constitute new gauge invariant operators that were not present as gauge invariant operators in the parent n equals 4 theory. So these are the duals of twisted states in the closed string conformal field theory. So what we want to do is study the effective potential on this parallel branch of the moduli space where our adjoint scalar bosons X get these diagonal VEVs. And as I say, this was done earlier by Seitler and Zaremba, and what I want to do here is rederive their result, taking care to keep track of all the renormalization issues that appear in the field theory, and then generalize it to the generic orbifolds.
So again, pictorially, yeah. The instability is doing what in this case?
So in this case, there's the whole moduli space is this parallel branch where the fractional D brains are separating from each other, and it's just separating. Yeah, you can think of it as the near horizon limit of separating brains. Well, you can think of it as separating brains that carry the SUN1 label and those that carry the SUN2 label.
And again, so separating them in the XI.
In the transverse R6. Yeah. But in a way which respects the SUN, which essentially keeps them on a sphere. Yeah, this geometrical picture will be very useful when we consider the instability structure later. But for now, I'm just going to proceed with the sort of algebraic analysis of the renormalization of this theory. So let's think about the effect of potential, which includes bare terms and the one-loop contributions which arise from integrating out states which are massive on this branch. And you can think of these as coming from strings that stretch between the separated D-brains. They're masses. For the off-diagonal bosons in SUN, from the commutator terms, you get masses of this sort, where these A and B indices are SUN indices. Well, they label the diagonal element of these diagonal matrices that describe the VEVs of the scalars. And similarly, for off-diagonal bosons in the second SUN, you have masses that take this form. And for the bifundamental fermions, you have masses that arise when you separate the type 1 brains from the type 2 brains. Integrating them out leads to a contribution to the effect of potential of this form, which is divergent and requires counterterms in order to renormalize.
This is for short distances.
I'm sorry.
This is for short distances, the short distance.
It's a short distance singularity in the field theory, sure.
The potential is relative. The force computed is relative.
No, the force will be valid at sort of order one. Well, I'll explain exactly where the force is, where the potential is valid. It will not be valid near the origin because it will be large logs. Okay. So you might be wondering what these, this renormalization procedure that I'm about to discuss, the fact that we have to introduce counterterms, means. In field theory, it means the same thing it always means, that we need to pick a renormalization group trajectory. And once we do, the couplings of the theory at one renormalization scale M are related to those at another scale M prime by the renormalization group equations. But there is this choice of which trajectory we want to lie on, which is a choice of the exact quantum field theory that we're talking about. Now, because we want to take the duality seriously, we expect that there's a corresponding choice on the gravity side. And of course, people have worked out some aspects of the relation between renormalization group equations and gravity side field equations. We are at very small radius on the gravity side, so those concrete results are not really directly applicable. But we expect that there is a similar result, that there's a corresponding choice of essentially boundary conditions of the gravity side fields, which corresponds to this choice of renormalization group trajectory in the field theory. And it would be interesting, obviously, to work that out once the remote signal models are better understood.
So what are the couplings here? Just one gauge coupling for each gauge?
I'm gonna explain that. Okay, so we had this general expression for the effect of potential, which had a divergent contribution at one loop, which is canceled by appropriate counterterms that we fix by imposing a particular renormalization condition. And following Coleman and Weinberg, this is a very natural one to pick, where we insist that the fourth derivative of the potential at some mass scale m is given by the renormalized value of our couplings. Putting that in and doing some algebra leads to this expression for the effect of potential. Which we can simplify by appealing to the symmetries and inheritance properties that we know to be true of these orbifold theories. So we start off, to answer your question, with quartic scalar couplings corresponding to each of these combinations of differences of coordinates, and the original Yang-Mills coupling of the n equals 4 theory. These different couplings are related to each other by the Z2 quantum symmetry of the orbifold and the fact that planar diagrams are inherited in such a way that all these quartic scalar couplings can be identified, and we'll just...
Can I ask about the matching of parameters? So you start with the n equal 4 theory,
mm-hmm.
and then you divide it by the gamma.
Mm-hmm.
So lambdas and g ampers, etc., the parameter of these fields. So there has to be corresponding parameter in the gravity side. Mm-hmm. But there are too many for
what? I'm going to discuss that at the end. That has to do with understanding what double trace perturbations mean on the gravity side. Mm-hmm. It's an extremely interesting question. I don't think it's well understood even in supersymmetric versions. So that it's a very interesting question. I think it should correspond to something on the gravity side. But I'm going to just continue on the field theory side, keeping track of all these freedoms.
Is there a question about which renormalization group probably we are?
Yes, yes. So in other words, there's a finite piece to each of these couplings. And again, the symmetries constrain them to essentially one coupling. But there's a finite piece to this that is not determined by anything here. And I think on the gravity side, it would correspond to some boundary condition.
Particular choice of parameter. Would this be possible that duality to gravity for particular choice of parameter?
I think if you have a theory and it has some deformations, if you had a dual description of it, you better see those same deformations. However, the standard orbifold might only be dual to one of them, and that's one of the things I'll say when we get to a little bit later.
Where does the e to the 25?
Okay, that comes from this condition. When you differentiate this, you get. is there a simple way to? You'll see this in the original Coleman-Weinberg papers too. It's not new. There's a log, so you get a 20. Yeah, what you get is a 25.6 or something, like that. And then you put it in the log. It comes very cleanly from this condition. Okay. there are going to be more fun numbers later.
Minus 4 plus 1.
Number of physical polarizations of photon in a boson
against the earth. This is not.
Yeah, let's make that very clear.
It's a dual.
So we have this expression. Now, you can see that, as in the old Coleman-Weinberg type analysis, you can see that the effective coordinate coupling that's emerged here is some renormalized coupling still to be understood, plus a logarithmic contribution, which ruins perturbation theory if these logs get too large. And so, starting to answer somebody's question about the regime of validity, it's going to be where these logs are not too large. So the nebs of these differences in the x's need to be of order m, and not parametrically smaller or greater than that, and perturbation theory will be fine. But that means that we can't go to the origin. So in fact, want to say that here, we'll be in particular interested in what's going on near the minima of this potential. And these logs, if they get large, ruin perturbation theory. So we want to renormalize at a scale which is such that at the minimum x of the potential, the logs are not too large, which is to say we want to set the VEV of X, which satisfies this condition, to be something of order M. And when you do that, you find a relation between lambda and the Yang-Mills coupling, which leads to this much simpler expression for the effective potential. And we therefore recover the expression of Zeitlin and Zarembo.
Because the feeling for this expression, yeah. You can take the x's to be, or the separation between the x's to be largest compared to the string scale, for example.
Well, on the field theory side, there's no string scale. This is a quantum field theory.
Right. But if I translate that back into on the deep brain side,
that's a more involved question that I don't. I'm going to just work in the field theory until the very.
You don't know if you can pull them apart further than.
I mean, of course, you can pull them way further apart than the string scale and use classical gravity, but this expression There's,
I thought that original quiver gauge theory is derived in DKPS limit around the world and Douglas.
Sure.
So therefore, the X should be of order.
Oh, it's much, no, right. If you're in the near horizon limit, you never go beyond the asymptotic string scale. I thought you were asking about backing away from the near horizon limit and still using this kind of expression. You have to of course use the full sum over oscillator modes, which isn't included here.
Okay, yeah, I guess you mentioned that these powers look a little bit funny from the space time point of view, and so I was trying to figure out to what extent we should be thinking of this from the space time point of view.
I think this what Steve is referring to is the fact that these forces, as I'm going to discuss also later, grow with distance. If you think about this potential is giving you a force between brains, it grows like x to the fourth, and this is an interesting feature that will affect our analysis of the minima. And I think this will persist to the full D-brain system, but that's something that we can discuss later. Okay, so you can already see that this is going to lead to an instability because the log is negative when these X differences are less than the order of the mass scale. And we've arranged things so that that is a reliable statement. And we're going to study things in that regime. So far I parameterized things in terms of the coordinates on this parallel branch, which were the diagonal elements of those adjoint scalar matrices. And you might wonder what it is in terms of gauge invariant operators. The full expression would be quite complicated, but the quartic term is important to consider and is simply expressed in terms of gauge invariance of the original field theory. So now these X's are the full adjoint matrices. And the quartic contribution, the logarithmically divergent 4-point one-loop amplitude, is proportional to this sum of double trace operators, each of which is the square of a twisted operator in the field theory. So if you exchange 1 and 2, each of these operators goes to minus itself at x. It transforms under that Z2 symmetry, but we're talking about the square of it, which can consistently be generated in this orbifold model. And
can I think of this as saying that you're adding this, this corresponds to the parameter, this corresponds to the parameter lambda?
I think, yeah, there's this choice of RG trajectory, which is a choice of the finite piece of the counter term, which includes this 4-point contribution. Proportional to these operators.
So this is the operator which we should look for in the gravity side. You are in order to identify what is the parameter in the gravity side?
Yes, that is a very interesting question. And indeed, that's how I think about it, that it's that ambiguity in the field theory side. Okay, so just to summarize where we are, this effective potential that we've calculated generates an instability along which twisted operators are encouraged to get VEVs. And it's reliable for x of order m or m tilde here, but becomes unreliable as you try to go to the origin. So we've identified what's a global instability at least, and what's going on at the origin is not yet clear from this analysis. Okay, and also what's going on arbitrarily far is also not. Yes.
Stupid question. If those twisted operators get VEVs,
yes,
do you break the original quantum symmetry of the orbital?
Sure. So the point being that the tachyon was a twisted operator. There's an instability which encourages it to condense. This instability that we found encourages twisted operators at weak Tuft coupling or small radius to condense. So the quantum numbers agree with what you expect from a tachyon, and we'll later see that the n counting also agrees. But first, let me just show you quickly that this generalizes very easily to arbitrary orbifolds, which are not freely acting, so that you have this branch of moduli space. So let's consider, just to be general, a fairly general, a Zn orbifold of two complex planes, leaving the third complex plane invariant. That'll lead to adjoint fermions coming from this Z3 coordinate of a SUN to the n, little n, gauge group. And the scalars along the Z1 and Z2 direction end up in bifundamental representations indicated here, depending on the angles of rotation, as do the fermions. And these, the particular bifundamental representation that appears is just determined by the Lorentz quantum number of the mode that you're considering. And again, there's a quantum symmetry in this case. Oh, I should have, this is a misprint. It's a Zn quantum symmetry, which permutes these SUN gauge groups. So going on the branch of the moduli space where the D-brains, fractional D-brains separate, or said differently, where the adjoint scalars get diagonal VEFs, we again find a Coleman-Weinberg potential going like x to the fourth log x for various separations x, determined by the exact Lorentz quantum numbers of the orbifold. And finally, just to reiterate, in the case of a free action on the S5, we would have not had this branch at all. And the tree-level interactions of the gauge theory in that case prevent a destabilizing potential for twisted operators. The minus signs come from the fact that here what we're doing is we're integrating out fermions, which whose masses are given by this difference. And half the fermions have this mass and half have this mass, determined by the bifundamental representation in which they transform. Well, again, it you lose control as soon as X gets too big. Well, they both have the same general features. There's also a minus term. There's also a...
Yeah, I'm still a little bit confused about your statement about the range and validity of this potential that you're calculating. If you're calculating it in perturbation theory, and yet you say it's not good near the origin.
Well, there is a better, I mean, presumably you can use a randomization, but you should be able to discuss it from our effects.
There's a possibility of using the normalization group to sum up these logs. We haven't done that yet because it seems like two-loop information is.
Put in the coupling.
But there are a lot of couplings in this theory.
You only have one.
In order to do that, as I understand it, you need to take all the couplings into account, make sure that none of them are strong in the region you want to calculate, and then. If that's true, if all of them are weak in this region, you have control. So we
I thought the symmetry gave you just one coupling.
It gives you just one. Well, okay.
Let's take the one that both the type zero.
Okay. So right. Okay, well, it's not clear to me that that's all that you need for this renormalization group improved calculation, because that could be true. I'm just trying to be conservative. Okay.
I mean, I just wonder whether it looks to me like you're going to be led.
I mean, normally the way it works in phi to the fourth theory is that it becomes bad at large x, right? It becomes bad at large energy.
In phi to the fourth.
I mean, just plain old phi to the fourth.
Phi to the fourth.
Yeah.
It becomes bad in the
right, which is in this case in this
large.
Right. So you what? What you can do there is you can understand what happens at the origin, but you can't understand what happens at large.
Yeah, unless the theory is not to be free.
Right.
Whereas the future is here.
here we don't know. I mean, that's part of what we want to do. We want to actually work at finite and see what the gauge, what all the couplings are doing. And this most of the couplings here have zero beta functions at this large n order. There's this weird non-planar one that we're discovering here, this double trace perturbation that emerges. Yeah. That's right. So this comes from the running of the coupling corresponding to this double trace perturbation. Right. I mean, I don't know yet because we want to do this carefully.
What you could have done is just from your one loop expression write down the beta function matrix and just by inspection see if it has radiative symmetry around it. That's how we understand electroweak symmetry.
I'm not sure what's the difference between that and this.
Well, you could resum the logs and then there's no question about worrying about what happens at the order.
Sure.
That's right. I just want to be careful because there are so many different couplings that could have existed here, including, for example, the relative gauge couplings between the two SUNs, and...
You're saying... for one loop on the finer order.
Yeah.
The gauge couplings will also be...
No, that's... They won't... Well, the... let me see if I can get this right. The twisted ones might, but the... Yeah, I mean, okay, I'm saying something more conservative than I might be able to say. That's true.
But it's not precluded that you could establish that this theory was truly unstable.
It's not precluded, but I kind of... doubt it. I think that because I think at this level I think it might not end up being asymptotically free. But I agree that I should be able to study it either at the origin or at large X. But it depends on how these.
So let me just arrange things quick. If I take end to infinity,
yeah.
Keep it infinity.
Yes.
The gauge couplings are don't
Yes.
The only coupling that runs is this double trace coupling you introduced.
Mm-hmm. And its renormalization group equation includes the bare values of the other couplings which don't run.
Right.
So that leads to a kind of bizarre...
In that case, I should be able to just... It seems to me... from the expression you've already written down, determine whether how it's running. Well, this expected potential already satisfies the normalization of the equation.
Yes, I agree.
You're saying it looks like the same analysis as Y4th, except I have a sign.
No, here it's similar, except that you have these other couplings. You have the gauge couplings, and you have
you're taking end of time.
Right, I'm just saying you have the constant values of those gauge couplings, which are not running. So, but they come into the equation. They come into the RG equation, and they lead to a strange solution, which I don't understand yet. Can we talk about this? I know what you're saying, but I'm a little puzzled by these sort of leading n equations that emerge. So I'm saying something that's true, but it might not be as much as could be said.
It seems to me there's still a very open possibility. Maybe it's just because that this theory is just unstable.
I agree. I'm not saying anything different. But there is going to be a local minimum where there's other things going on.
You mean unstable large ones?
Look at that.
Yeah, you take that as a
potential,
that's
lower minimum. Well, you have to be a little careful in just saying it from this, because if you add up, for example, if you just took x sub 1 here and made it as large as possible, these terms cancel against these terms. That's
could be possible.
Yeah, no, I mean, it is an important point, and it's related to large N inheritance, that these coefficients are such that that term that you're, I think, looking at cancels exactly. That I agree in principle that we...
You're saying this form is always possible?
No, I'm just saying that the leading N contribution is... cancels out, and then there's something else that I'm going to talk about. Okay. These double trace operators that we've generated turn out to affect the physics, even though it comes from a non-planar diagram. They turn out to affect the physics at leading order in N. And let me explain that slowly. So let me take a scaling in which we take the whole tree-level Lagrangian and include the 1 over G Engel squared out front of that, which goes like N over the Tuft coupling. And then what we've generated in this scaling is a one-loop contribution with no powers of G Engels, and therefore no powers of N out front. So what I'm going to do first is consider the theory before we generate this correction and ask how to normalize the operators so that their correlation functions scale like m squared at large n. And then I'll consider the effects of bringing down powers of this perturbation into their correlation functions.
Can't you just say that every trace is in order n, and therefore the two
Well, I'll show you what I can say, and probably it's the same thing. So, just to normalize the operators, consider the operator trace x squared, for example. In this normalization, propagators, this two-point function is calculated by making contractions between the x's, which can be depicted as I've done here. And in the normalization that I gave, propagators scale like 1 over n, and these traces scale like n. So we find that we need a normalization factor of n for each of the operators in order for the whole thing to scale like n squared. And you find then that, indeed, higher point correlation functions also scale like n squared with this normalization. Okay, now let's add this perturbation going like order 1 times trace x squared squared and consider how it affects correlation functions. It affects correlation functions by being brought down into the correlation functions in this way. And if you calculate this correlation function at the level of keeping track of the powers of n, you see that because this is a composite operator, there's a connected diagram in which we just contract this x squared with that one and this one with a completely different one, which leads to 4 propagators, 4 trace factors, and again, keeping our normalization we determined up here for the operators, an extra n squared that leaves this diagram also scaling like n squared. Okay, are there any questions about that?
Well, I really is something to say, delta L is order n squared, period. And therefore, adding it to some action, which is also order n squared.
That's a simpler way to say it. But here, actually, it's useful. What I just said is useful for keeping track of the orbifold quantum numbers, because the actual operators that we add are of this twisted form, and bringing down a power of this in the same way, the similar way to the way I just explained for the generic n counting, the leading effect is a factorized contribution in which the square of the twisted operator separates into one of the twisted operators in a correlation function with some subset of the other operators in the correlation function times the other one. And each of these, if these other operators are totally untwisted, will vanish, canceling the large n contribution. However, if these other operators are twisted, then there's no selection rule preventing this from contributing. And so we find that correlation functions of untwisted operators are not affected by this perturbation, which is in line with the concrete inheritance properties that were determined on the field theory side of these orbifold models. But we do find that correlators of twisted operators are affected at genus zero, at order n squared. Okay, are there any questions about this? Okay.
Are you talking near the origin of the moduli space, or are you already?
This would be true whether or not we stay near the origin, but I'm indeed thinking near the origin. In saying this, but yeah.
On the granite side.
No, I'm sorry. Let me just. In other words, there aren't any extra powers of n that appear in going away from the origin.
Does this double trace perturbation correspond to compensation of some bound states on the granite side?
Well, the weird thing is it would have to be condensing a two-particle state without having condensed the single-particle state. And I'm going to talk more about this. This is something that's an interesting puzzle that some of us are trying to resolve. Okay. Okay, so we have found an instability for twisted operators at large, which affects the theory at large n, and this suggests that the tachyon instability has persisted to small ADS radius, at least globally. Maybe clearly we could do better by doing the renormalization group improved treatment of the perturbation theory, but with what we have done, this much is clear. Now, it's interesting to see what happens when we condense these twisted operators. And so I want to study in a little bit of detail the a couple of interesting local minima of the effective potential, and these are indeed only local minima, and I don't know what happens beyond these local, too far beyond these local minima. A thing to keep in mind as we discuss this is the fact that these forces are non-local, long-distance forces that grow with distance, and if you forget that, you can get confused. So I'm going to do two configurations, one of which I'll start with has some instabilities left, and then I'll go to a completely stable configuration. But both of them are very simple geometries. So let's start going back again to the type 0 case with a configuration where x1 is distributed uniformly on some, has vectors which are distributed uniformly on some S5. That satisfies the SUN condition that the sum of the eigenvalues vanish. And let's leave x2 at the origin. So that preserves an SUN from the second SUN and breaks the first SUN down to U1s. So in this configuration, you can work out, at least approximately in the large N limit, what the effective potential looks like as a function of the radius of this sphere of type 1 brains surrounding the set of type 2 brains at the origin. And you find, again, a weird exponential arising, but again, essentially the same form of potential, rho to the fourth log rho squared over m squared, which goes down and then goes back up. We only feel confident about the results near rows of order m, so that's why I've scratched out the rest, at least before we do this RG treatment. And the minimum is indeed at some row of order m. Okay, so what we really would like to know, though, is more than the radial behavior, but, you know, what the spectrum of the theory is that remains once we've condensed the twisted operators and arrived at this point. So if you do a small fluctuation analysis, you find that the scalars associated with the second SUN group are massive in this configuration, but the angular degrees of freedom of these ones that are distributed on the sphere are not. The fermions are massed up, So at the center, we've got at low energies a pure glue SUN QCD theory. But on the sphere, we have some instabilities left. So let's go to another configuration, which.
Before the other configuration, yeah. So what's your guess as to where those instabilities take you?
To the other configuration. So. Okay. So the other configuration, again, keeps an SUN2 at the origin, not having turned on VEVs for any of the X2s. But we put the X1s that separated along some line on opposite sides from the type 2 brains in the center, as I've indicated here. In this case, if you do a small fluctuation analysis, you find positive mass squares for all modes. And so we seem to, in this case, end up with, at least locally near this minimum, with pure glue QCD at low energies in each of these three sectors.
So does it work when you divide the brains into two bunches?
There are lots of different configurations you might consider. These are just a couple, which are local. Well, this is one, which is a local minimum.
This is the absolute local minimum.
Okay, I don't know that. First
of all, you can't exclude the possibility that there is a deeper minimum at the origin.
That's also
right.
True. That's also true. Although that would be very surprising from the gravity point of view.
We should discuss about that.
Okay.
Because she doesn't know what the conversion would be.
Well,
this potential could be reliable.
Yeah, but from gravity side, I have a different. I discussed this with Eva yesterday at lunch. But I believe that from gravity point of view, that at least for small radius, that there should be a stable point in the origin.
Okay, I would like to discuss that. I don't see that we have an independent way of establishing that on the gravity side. And it seems to me that a potential which is unstable at the origin on the field theory side is consistent with the reality of the operator dimensions that you have in the tree level theory. So sort of extrapolating the Brein-Lehner-Friedman bound to small radius is, to me, very problematic.
How do you say it?
The reason I believe is that for fixed G square n and large n, the Hilbert space of the model, the theory is always a Fock space of particles. However difficult it is to solve string theory in this background, but it is true that perturbative string theory description is valid. So therefore, the Hilbert space should be Fock space of string state. And so then you have mass of these string particles. Now some of them can be tachyonic.
What do you mean by mass at small radius?
Well, the reason, once again, so I just state once again what I said. So you have a string, whatever the radius it is, the string theory description, the perturbative string description is valid.
Mm-hmm.
So the Hilbert space is a Fock space of string state. Now, so then you look at the first quantized stream in this background. The Hilbert space of the first quantized stream is decomposed into representations of the SO2,4. And then there is a parameter of that representation. So if as far as the theory is unitary, then the representation of SO2,1s are all unitary type.
Right, so it's a unitary representation, which means in particular the dimensions of the operators are real.
No.
There
are unitary representations which are tachyonic.
Okay.
And so you can have a tachyon or massive particle.
Okay. All right. Okay.
But what I'm saying is that as far as the mass of that tachyon is independent, does not grow up for small radius, which is my assumption, then so you have this a spectrum of masses of string state. And then for each string state, you can analyze where the state is stable. And then you can do the Brighton-Lohner-Friedman type analysis for each of these string states. And unless the mass grows up.
Sorry, how are you analyzing
the that is grows up near the origin as the radius goes to zero.
Go ahead.
You're simply saying because the bound grows up.
But the bound is a super gravity analysis.
Yeah, the bound gets bigger.
Bound goes to negative infinity, right. So as far as the mass square.
But then it's reasonable that the mass should also go to the minus infinity. Yeah. It's only a question of which overtakes which.
Right? Well, but that's the mass comes from the
string propagated in this background, which is characterized by that radius.
Right. I mean, how do you know what this is not a BPS formula? How do you know what the mass is as a function of the ADS radius? You know the dimensions of operators. That's what you know. Mm-hmm. And this potential is not inconsistent with having operators that have, you can have a marginal operator which comes into a dynamically generated potential with a minus sign.
Let me ask, because the curvature of the potential, you see that there's a potential with curvature. So you're seeing that you are extrapolating the curvature of the potential near the origin, right? That doesn't seem to be blowing up.
That's true. This formula wouldn't suggest that it blows up.
So I'm saying that as far as the curvature of the
zero, it
does not blow up. But then I thought that ADS radius would be stagnant.
Why?
Well, at that point, why is the Breitenwohler-Friedman bound the right
bound? Right, that's
the higher curvature terms of gravity are as important as the ones that they kept giving us.
Right.
Yeah, but still, it's a large N, so the perturbative analysis is fine. So you can still solve the free wave equation.
But wait, you can't solve just the free wave equation. You have to include all the higher derivative terms.
Yeah, all alpha prime correct.
But then that is included in the spectral mass.
Wait. The wave equation you've got that came from linearizing around.
Is encoded in the
map.
I thought
Brian Warner
Friedman was.
No. I mean, you're linearizing the supergravity equation.
No. I'm not talking about supergravity equation. I'm only talking about the representation of SO2,4.
Yeah.
And all the non-trivial alpha prime correction is encoded in the decomposition of Hilbert space into the
that's true, but where did you get the Friedman Breitenwohler bound come from?
You're comparing them to a bound which goes to
where does that bound come from?
Right, as soon as you get to string scale.
In other words, why the bound is just a statement of what stability means in ADS.
In supergravity, in ADS. That's right, the linearized supergravity equations, right?
So you don't know what it means
right. If you're...
And furthermore, if you just work in field theory, just look at the field theory.
You just look at field theory.
You know, you can have perfectly real operators. Yeah. I'm sorry. Yeah. Okay. I mean, I think what's going on the gravity side is a very interesting question, and I hope this motivates looking at it more. But I think the field theory is the most reliable guide in this region. Now, having said this, it's tempting to conjecture, so we will, that this is indeed described by the gravity side after at least partial tachyon condensation on the gravity side. So I've already said a lot of this, but let me just put it up. We don't know too much about the gravity side at small radius, but there are some heuristic ideas about what should happen to closed string theories upon activating various instabilities. Tachyon instabilities, as Joe and DeAlmas and Schimmerich suggested long ago, seem to lead to a reduction in the number of dimensions of the theory, since the tachyon vertex operator at zero momentum is relevant on the string world sheet, with the dilaton gradient and other gradients making up the difference and continuing to cancel the world sheet beta functions. Somewhat at the heuristic level, similarly, there's been a lot of discussion of decays to quote-unquote nothing at the non-perturbative level, which might be related to these tachyon condensation processes by changing knobs of scalar fields. And both arguments suggest heuristically losing degrees of freedom. Now, in our situation, on the field theory side, we get a precise indication of how many degrees of freedom we lose in this condensation process. At least to the level that we've studied so far around this local minimum that I discussed. And you find that the quiver theory goes to something which in the infrared is given by pure glue QCD sectors with these gauge groups. And there are massive scalars and fermions at much higher energies.
Are you going to explain how this tachyon for large disk then in gravity?
Oh, at large disk then it's just a twisted sector mode of the orbifold, which comes in the standard way from working out the vacuum energy in the twisted sector on the string world sheet.
Oh, you're assuming that this pipe is almost flat?
Well, you just said at large G squared N, that's true, and then you can use
it. You do the flat space analysis you apply.
For large G squared N, the flat space analysis is good, and you get the tachyon in the usual way.
Okay,
so Polyakov has been saying for years that there should be a non-critical string dual for QCD, and perhaps these results are further evidence in that direction. Although,
so the mass of tachyon that comes from the twisted sector for large G square N is what order is it?
String scale.
Negative mass
scale. Yes.
And is there a reason to think that that depends on the radius?
Yeah, I guess so. Well, everything's going to depend on the radius at some level. But
it has a limit for large infinite radius.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, sure. It's not. It has a finite limit as you take the radius to infinity. There's another case which I don't have time to discuss today involving discrete torsion where there's some momentum dependence. There's a kind of intermediate case between this free acting case and the non-free acting Zn cases that I've been discussing, which is a Zn times Zn orbifold with a non-trivial choice of discrete torsion. What that means is that the twisted sector of one Zn theory, its vacuum is projected out by the other Zn. So in particular, the lowest lying tachyon gets projected out. However, you have momentum modes, which dress the vertex operators and lead to invariant tachyon modes, which are slightly less tachyonic. And these do have some clear dependence on the ADS radius. And heuristically there, you'd say that as you squish the ADS radius, these tachyons should go away. On the field theory side, in those cases, what we find is indeterminate. The one loop contribution vanishes, so we don't find this Coleman-Weinberg effect. However, at one loop. However, the branch along which it could occur is present, and so presumably it does arise at higher orders. But that's an interesting case to pursue further. So I've, because of the discussion, I've gone on pretty long here, but I wanted to discuss those two puzzles that I mentioned, so let me just do that. I will not be offended if people leave, and it shouldn't take too much longer. As various people have been saying, understanding the gravity side would be very interesting. Now, if we import our intuition from ordinary closed string theory to this highly curved Lemoine background, we get some interesting puzzles. So if you take an ordinary closed string orbifold model, since all the operators of the model, the twisted operators and the untwisted operators, are simply subsets of the operator spectrum of the original parent sigma model, if that parent sigma model has symmetries like the SO42 symmetry of the ADS times S target space, it's preserved by the orbifold theory at genus zero. This is what prompted Shamit and I to say, the last ITP workshop, that these models should be exactly conformable large N.
The generators aren't projected out.
And the generators are not projected out here. So,
why you say that the twisted operators have and the original model twisted operators have those that have the local?
No. What I said was precise about what I meant there. Consider the world sheet sigma model on the parent's target space. Okay, it has a large set of operators, some subset of those operators are vertex operators for string states. Okay, you can do two things with that sigma model, at least. One of them is to simply make the string theory describing strings propagating on the parent target space. The other thing you can do is project out to some set of operators invariant under the orbifold symmetry, and then add in additional operators from the spectrum of operators of the sigma model, which are now mutually local with this reduced set of untwisted operators. Those are the twisted operators. But all of the above came as operators in the original sigma model. And if that sigma model has the symmetry, you wouldn't expect even the twisted states to violate it, as I understand it.
Well, I'm a little confused by that. Yeah. These are non-local operators in the parent theory, and they're strings that literally don't close.
True, but the yeah.
They're such non-local operators that
right.
Become closed string operators
yes.
in the
mm-hmm. theory. Yep. Okay. Right. But they're all operators in this conformal, in this, in other words, there are fewer operators that describe string states than there are operators in the abstract conformal field theory.
I find that a little confusing from the abstract conformal field theory point of view.
Okay.
Because if you take chiral algebra,
yeah.
and then you take the invariant chiral algebra, you know that there are representations of the invariant chiral algebra which are not, in any sense, representations of the original chiral algebra. Mm-hmm. Those are the twisted representations.
Let's see.
So somehow this non-locality, stop states in the apparent theory of getting around that problem.
Okay.
So I had the same problem that Lubitsch had.
Functional circle, right?
Yeah.
It's kind of a default by group isomorphic to Z. And all the winding strings have the twisted sectors of this orbit called that. And what you say is the parent theory contains also winding strings that arbitrary contains
right.
binding.
Yes, and the reason they're not part of the string spectrum is because they're not mutually local with
right.
the vertex operators describing strings. And but they're present as operators in the conformal field theory.
But then the parent algebra contains kind of all conformal field theories you can imagine.
No, it contains ones with, you know, which are related to this particular target space or its orbifolds. No, it's not, you can't get anything from it. But okay. Well, let me just continue because
but if you have the symmetry generators are preserved by the orbifolding action and are not projected out, then whatever spectrum of states you have, they're going to form representations of the symmetry, and so we don't need to worry about whether they came from the parent theory or not. Okay? The only issue is whether the symmetry algebra is preserved by the orbifolding action.
Right, but the question is whether they are...
And everything forms representations of it. They have to.
That's right.
That's
only right. Yeah, so let me continue. One of the possibilities is, of course, that this was too quick. It worked for the untwisted operators very nicely, and maybe it doesn't work when twisted operators are included. And indeed, the puzzle is that we have a mass scale appearing. We have a beta function coming in this non-planar order for this double trace operator. And it affects the theory at genus zero.
Is it possible that perturbation you are making is upsetting the Lagrangian sum? So you're assuming that this operator appears with order one coupling in the Lagrangian.
Well, you find that that's true.
Yeah, but this has to be normalized as n squared.
No, in the original theory, it's normalized as n squared. It describes a two-particle state.
Yes.
But there's a difference between thinking of it as an operator in the original theory and having it included as a perturbation of the Lagrangian, which is going on here. And this is a much more subtle thing. But anyway, it's different from what you're saying is the right scaling before the deformation.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. But this is the scaling of the deformation. It's a one loop effect, so it's order g yang goes to the zero.
Oh.
Okay, so there are various interpretations of this. One of them is, of course, that this argument was too quick because it's a Ramon sigma model, or because it's too quick. to begin with. But I find it pretty convincing, so there are other alternatives, one of which is that there could be, in fact, a line of fixed points on the field theory side which simply don't go through weak coupling. We found these beta functions in a weak coupling expansion of the quiver theory. We don't know, we can't rule out the possibility that there's a strongly coupled line of fixed points. But I would still say, because of this choice of renormalization of lambda, that the quantum field theories that we did study here should have some gravity dual. And therefore, independently of this, it's interesting to try and understand what that, what the form of such a gravity dual could be.
What are inheritance properties?
Okay, so the at large end, correlators of untwisted operators are inherited from the n equals 4 theory, and that can be understood on both sides of the duality, and it's been checked out. So, so what I'm saying is that these quantum field theories have the quantum symmetry corresponding to the orbital fold, and the potential respected the inheritance of amplitudes at large end that you should have in the orbital fold theory. Okay, but there is this choice of precise renormalization group trajectory, and that is a choice of the coefficient of the finite contribution to the coefficient of this operator. And double trace operators in ADS have not been understood yet, and there are some interesting ideas that Ofer and Mika have been pursuing on that, which I'm going to mention in a second. And so one possibility here is that the gravity side is more subtle than we thought because of the fact that it's a double trace perturbation that we've generated. And of course, the last possibility, which should always be kept in mind in the non-supersymmetric context, is that the duality could fail or be mitigated, shall we say, by phase transitions. But I'd like to say that I think this is a very detailed duality map that's been developed, and the contributions of the calculations that I was discussing today, I think, add to that evidence. So finally, this cryptic comment about double trace operators is related to the following observation. If you consider the diagrammatics of this theory, when we add a double trace perturbation to the Lagrangian, that means that we've, in terms of the double line notation, introduced a coupling of this sort where we join two strips, right? If you think about the index structure of this is what's been added to the theory. And if you follow a Tiftian argument, keeping track of the topology of the diagrams that ensues from introducing this additional interaction, filling in the field theory diagrams into string diagrams based on their effective genus, you get a picture that looks something like this, with an ordinary smooth world sheet plus contributions coming from world sheets in which this counter term has connected two pieces of the diagram in this way, and you'd have a series of such contributions.
Yeah, the same order, same order.
Same order and different order in this H. So this leads to a question of whether this choice of counter term in the field theory translates into a sensible choice of contact terms on the gravity side of the ADS-CFT duality here. And I find this a very intriguing question, which these guys had been studying independently in the context of a double trace deformation of the conifold theory. So hopefully we can understand what's going on here.
First of all, the remark that the double trace terms are considered in the non-critical Lorentz term.
Right, as David pointed out to us, there was a picture like what I just drew that was realized in the old matrix models. So we might get some inspiration from that.
Thought it would be pretty remarkable to have a turbulent modification of skin.
No, I think about it is that you can think of the double trace operators as coming, put in the Hilary field, being regarded as single trace operator but averaged over an ensemble of them. And they're all of the actions of the boundary.
It could be that that these contact terms belong at the boundary. That's definitely a possibility.
The boundary of ADS. Yeah.
Well, but you have to understand where that came from, and to me that might be explained by integrating out the massive stuff in the asymptotic region.
The whole point of averaging over the boundary, it's equivalent to some point of topic.
Certainly the TOFT argument would suggest what I drew, but it could be more subtle in this context.
That's me a lot of putting it in a squeezed state as opposed to a coherent state.
Can you elaborate on that?
Well, squeezed state is just a state where there's a different count. It's different. You squeeze the Gaussian, so it's not. It's the simplest two particles, or the simplest state you make out of two particles.
And it's precisely two particles?
Yeah.
The question is, why is there a correct singularity structure?
Well, it has, again, because you can think of it as an average.
Well, okay.
It's obvious, but it seems like, again, we know in gravity can't change the state. And this is a state which is a natural two-particle structure. Mm-hmm. The simple state with a natural two-particle structure is a squeeze state. The state with two-particle correlation is
both. Okay, but in normal ADS, you are changing effectively a parameter because you're changing the asymptotic value of some closed string state. So I'm not sure how to describe it as a state, but anyway, I didn't mean to say that this is the definitive interpretation. It's more of a question that I think is very interesting. So finally, there are a bunch of things to do here. First one is something that was already brought up. We'd like to do this RG improved perturbation theory to understand what's going on either at the origin or at long distances, if one of them has all couplings weak. And everything I've discussed has been in the strict large end limit. It would be very interesting to understand what goes on in these theories at finite end. A lot of dramatic things can happen. Scalar masses will be generated, etc. It'd be nice to construct examples where in these local minima, we don't just have pure glue QCD, but quark flavors survive. And presumably that would involve open strings also being present on the gravity side of the correspondence. It'd be interesting to do similar things for the other P brains, including those of type 2A theory, with the hope of understanding a connection to this stuff of Costa and Gutt-Pearl that we discussed earlier in the workshop that I find very interesting but confusing. So this seems like a setting in which we can really understand what happens when you condense tachyons. And finally, it'd be nice to go back to the gravity side and say what we can say using some combination of string field theory or D-brain probes. And this kind of logarithmic Kolmogorov-Weinberg potential seems very similar to some of those that have been computed in open string field theory, describing tachyon condensation there, which also have this kind of logarithmic behavior. So I wonder if that's not a coincidence. Anyway, let me stop there.
Thank you.